I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. The younger of my two boys once had a bunny named Oreo, and with a name like that, you can guess right off the bat this animal had a distinctive coloration. And if cookies are sweet little things, maybe bunnies are too, at least this one was. We're about to meet a young man who once had a bunny named Snickers, and I heard that name, and I thought of Oreo right off the bat, and then I thought of a sweet, nutty, nougaty, popular candy bar called Snickers. You've heard of it, too. And if Snickers is a suitable name for an animal, maybe the candy bar was the reason. I don't know. We might find out about this backstory of the name Snickers, this bunny. Snickers became the reason or the starting point for a remarkable years-long journey made by Caleb Smith. He's no relation to me, by the way. We just happen to be named Smith. Caleb Smith took a journey from being a kid who loved a furry mammal named Snickers to an entrepreneurial force, you could say, behind several projects, all of them featuring animals we call lagomorphs, bunnies. And every project is connected in some way with a remarkable spirit of compassion. Caleb Smith is founder of Peace Bunny Island in Newport, Minnesota. It's just outside St. Paul. Peace Bunny Island is an animal sanctuary. And in this location, rescued and rare heritage breed rabbits get trained as comfort animals. And as the teen CEO of the Peace Bunny Foundation, Caleb promotes and hosts rabbit-themed programs that are connected with STEM educational goals. And he's also now author of a memoir about how he got into all of this and what keeps him at it. The book is titled Peace Bunny Island, The Extraordinary Journey of a Boy and His Comfort Rabbits, and How They're Teaching Us About Hope and Kindness. He's on the line with us now. Caleb Smith, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me on today.
You know, can you even remember when you were eight? I can scarcely remember when I was eight, but is it like yesterday for you?
Oh, well, there's a lot of things that happened between 8 and 16, but there are a lot of good memories that I can remember from there.
You do remember Snickers, of course.
Yes.
Candy bar?
No.
Is there some reason for the name Snickers?
So the previous owner named them Snickers, and we just kept the name.
Okay. Well, was Snickers your very first bunny?
He was. We had a couple fish before him, but Snickers was our first really big pet in our house.
How many kinds of pets has your family had over the years?
Primarily fish and then rabbits. And then we fostered some cats and dogs short term. And now we have goats as well.
How did the rabbit come into your life in the first place, and why have you been so persistently interested in these bunnies or rabbits?
We finally just looked online for a pet and was looking for one that was smaller and one that, in terms of care, is more manageable than some other animals, and found a rabbit, started looking on Craigslist, found this one that was actually litter box trained, and Snickers grew up with cats, so he really thought he was a cat, so he'd go up and lick your hand and use a litter box, and was really well trained.
How long did you have Snickers?
A little less than a year.
Now, the Oreo bunny of my boys didn't live very long, and I understand this was a pivotal time, kind of a formative moment in your life to lose Snickers.
Yeah, it was difficult just because we had him. There was a lot of connection where, like with fish, you just watch them for a while. But with this rabbit, there was more of this relationship that we built together.
Well, this is just the starting part of the story. I'm going to jump clear to the end, and I want to know what Peace Bunny Island is actually today. I tried to describe it the best I could. But now, all these years later, here you are, operating this place, an island in the Mississippi, and it has a function. How would you describe what Peace Bunny Island is all about?
So in the book, it mentions about how it's Peace Bunny Island. It's 22 acres, and it briefly mentions in the epilogue, and what I have now is a chain of 5 islands, and they're just really this sanctuary that we could have the rabbit short-term. So they don't live out on the island. They just go there for kind of like a summer camp, short term. And that's where we train them to go to all these different events.
So when they're on the island, how are they housed?
So for day treks, they'll go out and they'll be up in tables and in pens and in wagons. And then depending on where they are on the island, they might we might let them out for a little break and run around in the vegetation and nibble on some of the grasses. And then we have a houseboat if we're doing overnight.
Now you say we, who is we in this venture actually?
The whole business, everybody, it's a part of my my furry friends and my non-furry friends.
How many non-furry friends are involved in this?
So in our biggest group, we have about 35 families of volunteers that help us in different parts of the business. There are about five or six families that primarily work on the island and boat piece.
The function, you say, is to prepare the bunnies to be suitable, to be taken out into communities, to do what specifically? Different types of functions, I understand.
Yeah, so they go to lots of fun places, birthday parties and egg hunts and senior centers and book clubs, wedding receptions, but then also times of tragedy, loss, and grief.
Yeah. So are you hanging out a shingle and saying we have bunnies, or how do people catch wind of the fact that this opportunity even exists for them? And how do they sign up?
Really, everything is word of mouth with how they find us. And we have a website that people will look up, fun rabbit events, and will end up finding us. And then we'll participate in one of our events. We have lots of stuff locally. Lots of stuff at the Peace Bunny Cottage, which is where the rabbits live year round. And then we've run some contests where people could win a trip to the island. So lots of people have found out that way. So it's been really fun to see the diversity of how people find us, because everybody has a unique story of how they came to find us.
So this seems like far more than just a hobby interest of yours. There's a reason for this beyond just amusement. And I want you to describe that. You've already hinted at it when you talked about not just birthday parties, not just those happy events, but they're also to provide comfort for people.
Well, it's really the rabbits are bringing just joy into the world, and bringing some hope is one of the biggest things. And sharing the rabbits with people and this persistence of bringing the rabbits, and this power of presence is what we call it, where we bring the rabbits to these different places and people can talk to the rabbits because they're very good listeners. And since they don't talk really back because they don't make any noise, then they just hold on to those secrets that people can tell the rabbits.
Well, this sounds like a very big operation, and I did use the term entrepreneurial when I was describing you to begin with. And there's something here. I mean, there has to be kind of a critical mass of devotion and commitment and some stick-to-itness. Most young people of your age aren't going to put together such an elaborate scheme. This is 22 acres, you say, on Peace Bunny Island, and a lot of people involved. This is more than an amusement for you, I would think.
Yeah, it's really just a full-on business now. And going and taking care of the rabbits every day and doing the chores and then going to all the fun events and just bringing the rabbits anywhere and sharing kindness with people. There's a lot of legwork behind the scenes with social media and websites and making contracts and making curriculum that we'll give to schools. And there's a lot of non-rabbit legwork that's also needed. But if it wasn't fun, I wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
So there are some things that not necessarily are my favorite, but altogether, it seems to be really fun.
Now, if you put the fun aside, I want to talk about the work behind this. And some of the work involves a vision of saying, I'm going to purchase an island. And I understand you rented the island first, but this is not common. You don't meet somebody every day of your age. How old are you at the moment?
I'm 16.
Yeah. So 16-year-old youth in our country don't typically buy islands. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. How did you pull that off?
So it was just talking to adults and not having the fear of being told no, and just reaching out to lots of different people and not having that fear of failing, and just asking for help, and just started contacting the different island owners after I had an idea around the Easter time frame, where I was tired of hauling all of the pens around, and said that if we have an island, the rabbits won't swim off, land predators won't get on, and the eagles will stay away if there are humans always keeping an eye on the rabbits. And at that point, it was just I just set it out of fatigue because we have so many events during the Easter time, and then everything expanded on from there.
22 acres. Do you need that many for bunnies?
Well, it was the closest one, and it was good for the rabbits, and it's also good for the humans. It's a good place to just escape and decompress, and it's good for the humans too.
Now, I want the story of the name Peace Bunny. Where does that come from?
So the last name of the American line, which comes from the four that I purchased off of Craigslist. After Snickers passed away, and I just made up the name. Paxton was really calming, and he was very peaceful, and just put it together with Peace Bunny, and he was Paxton Peace Bunny, and it flowed really well, and just stuck with it.
Yeah, pax or pox in Latin, that means peace. You know that.
Yes.
Yeah. So Paxton Peace Bunny is like Peaston Peace Bunny. It's kind of, it doubles up.
Yeah, he was always the most gentle and the most calming. But we also had Cream Puff Star and Casper, and they were peaceful too, but they didn't have peace in their name. So he just stuck it as a last name because they really all are peace bunnies.
Caleb Smith is with us. He is the founder of Peace Bunny Island in Newport, Minnesota, and he's the author of Peace Bunny Island, The Extraordinary Journey of a Boy and His Comfort Rabbits, and How They're Teaching Us About Hope and Kindness. I want to get into that, how they teach us about hope and kindness. It may be obvious on the surface of things that it just kind of is osmosis when you get close to one of these things, but we're going to ask Caleb about that after a short break here. Stay tuned. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's great to have with us right now Caleb Smith of Newport, Minnesota. He is the founder of Peace Bunny Island and author of Peace Bunny Island, The Extraordinary Journey of a Boy and His Comfort Rabbits, and How They're Teaching Us About Hope and Kindness. Before we get to the hope and kindness stuff, Caleb, which it might be kind of obvious how a bunny might bring that into our life, I want to see how a bunny really promotes a STEM education. How does that work? Because I know you take these bunnies into the schools too, expressly to promote STEM.
Yep. So we teach science, technology, engineering, and math with the rabbits. So we have different science teachers and math teachers that help write curriculum with us, and the rabbits are kind of the gateway into STEM, and people then will learn about the rabbits, and then it's kind of that slippery slope down the rabbit hole. And so every age group has their own like state standards of what we're teaching with the rabbits. So for more of the younger elementary, it's what makes a rabbit a rabbit. Herbivore, carnivore, omnivore, what do the rabbits eat? Because they're herbivores, they eat plants. Then as you get to middle school, it's like biodiversity, genetics, and then focusing more on the genetics, reproduction, upper middle school, high school age.
So it's kind of heavy on the science side, and the tech, engineering, and mathematics is a little bit less of interest.
There's a mixed balance. It's really all interwoven. There's different things, like we have some of the rabbits in our program that are agility rabbits. So they do obstacle courses. So people could build obstacle courses for the rabbits. And math is in everything we do. if we're getting 40 pounds of feed and we're getting 40 bags at a time, well, how many pounds are you really lifting in a day? And then what's that cost if they're 10 bucks a bag? So little things like that.
Do you hear back from the educators who sign up to be participants with this? Do you hear back from them that this is motivational or somehow advances their cause as teachers?
We've had a lot of feedback with the rabbits in the program. There was one school district in particular that had them in all of the rooms at their school, and how it wasn't just a educational purpose. It was really helping with the behavior of the kids as well, because whoever was the best for that day, like, got to feed the rabbit for that day. And if you were quiet, then you get to play with the rabbit later. And it was for them, it really helped the school as a whole with the kids. But we have some teachers that really enjoy the program and then have actually volunteered with us. So there's one science teacher, her name is Mrs. Lobbs, and Dr. Bonnie Lobbs, and she is one of our biggest volunteers and does lots of our science curriculum writing.
Now, I want to talk about the hope part and the kindness part. Am I supposed to understand that there's some kind of mystery about how the rabbits can make this happen? I mean, I'm predisposed to think of bunnies as spreading love around. Is there something more to it than what meets the eye?
Well, the rabbits, and I guess animals in general, always have this welcoming, atmosphere to them. And they, like I mentioned, it's just the power of presence and of the animals being there is spreading kindness. And with the rabbits, then they'll interact with people and people will open up to conversations. And here in Minnesota, gentlemen and males like myself don't tend to talk to each other face to face. But if we're shoulder to shoulder and we go fishing or we're watching a baseball game or petting a rabbit, then we can have these open conversations because we're not facing each other. So the rabbits are kind of this gateway of they can be interacting with one and then talking about whatever needs to be talked about.
Can we go back in your history to the point, because there's quite a story of you pitching this to your parents, I think, where somehow you had caught wind of the fact that if you want to be persuasive and you're presenting some kind of a business proposition, you got to do that presentation right. I don't know if you had a PowerPoint or how you pulled it off, but you actually formally presented a pitch to your parents.
Yes, I put on my church suit and walked down the hallway like I was on Shark Tank and just pitched the idea to my parents. It was all just paper-based. And I had a couple print-off sheets after looking on Craigslist for a pet rabbit and find that there were 362 of them, and seeing just the how many rabbits were for sale and having all the documents in paper and just pitching. A lot of it was just in my brain and then writing it down and seeing about this opportunity and then just pitching it to my parents and see what stuck. My parents said, if you find a way, we'll support you. So be careful what you promise your kids, or you'll be having an awesome time doing a podcast.
So you say you like Shark Tank, and that was kind of the model for what you did. You also, though, somewhere along the line, had some time going to, say, Rotary Clubs and being involved in the business community. Tell us about that, because that somehow shaped your outlook on how to get this job done.
Yeah, with the Rotary piece, I've grown up with Rotary my whole life. My mom was a part of Rotary, and I'm a fourth-generation Paul Harris Fellow with them, and continue to speak at some of their programs now with the book and about people finding their own peace, Bunny Island. And Rotary's always just been very impactful with them trying to eradicate polio. And then with the business side, met with different, because with Rotary and going to all these different things, lots of them are business people too. And when just learn lots from them. Lots of mentors I've met at all these different meetings, and went through different couple entrepreneurship contests with the business here in the Twin Cities area and in Minnesota. And people just opened the door, and they made connections that needed to be made. They helped me expand my business, and I've become valued mentors just in life as well.
You know, Caleb, our conversation could be all sweetness and light, but there's a downside or a dark side to some of these stories, and I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about here. Years ago in the Portland, Oregon area, as the backyard chicken craze took off, a lot of people got in. They bought their chickens. They thought this would be a good thing to do, and after a while, the care of the birds became too much for them, for many of these participants in this activity. And they started abandoning them. And sometimes at night, they'd drop them off near the local humane society. It was a significant enough problem that it got written up in the newspapers and got some national press. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the human capacity for staying with the care and the husbandry, the oversight of animals. Surely you've bumped into this kind of, I don't want to call it, well, I guess it is a dereliction of a duty, but people don't know how to get out of it. And there's a lot of, I guess, a lot of animal suffering that happens.
Well, it's really all on the beginning and the education, where a lot of people have unfair expectations with small animals and rabbits in particular, where like rabbits live 10 years and you have to, and they won't just sit on your lap and watch a sports game with you. They're very adventurous and they're very energetic. And a lot of people figure out that rabbits poop. Wow. and just little things that were, or people that found out that they were allergic to it the day after they got it. And a lot of it was preventable. So I focused more on the prevention side and started a fostering program and a bunny boot camp class. Where it was just education based, and I just wanted to stop the pet abandonment cycle and focus on the prevention piece of it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of good sense. But there will be the abandonment stories, and so that's, I guess, where the rescue aspect comes in. Do you have people dropping off bunnies at your place?
So our business is not formally a rescue. We do have some that we'll take in for specific reasons. It's more on a one-to-one basis. If some of them that we have in our program are endangered, and through Livestock Conservancy and in our program, we focus on those breeds anyway. So they're more of the bigger ones. There are a lot of smaller ones and what we'll call bunnies out there. And so there's each rabbit, there's 49 different breeds registered in the United States right now. And there's ranging from little rabbits like the Polish and the Netherland dwarfs that are about 2 pounds, all the way up to the Flemish giants that can be 20, 30 pounds. And Every rabbit's different, and then there are just some out there that are bunnies, and they're just a couple mixed breeds or a mutt, and they're super cute as well. And so we'll figure out if we can take them into our program and if it's a good fit. If not, we have other connections that might be able to take it in as well.
Do you expect that you can keep this up? I mean, going forward into the future.
Yeah, I feel really good with it. Right now, if I don't do the business any longer, we'll be taking care of the rabbits for the next 10 years because that's as long as they live. And I made a commitment that I'll take care of them their whole lives. But right now, it's just really sustainable and really excited to continue the business as long as I can.
You have found some enterprising ways to monetize aspects of this that I guess for a gardener are pretty obvious. You've already mentioned the poop, but is that a source of revenue that's considerable?
Yes. Not as much as some of the other aspects. But there's a little bit of unexpected income coming in that way that you might not take into account when you're making a budget, which is it's really fun just to see that roll in. Once I started selling the manure, I started calling myself an entre-manure.
And you did have to say roll in, didn't you? You catch my drift. Don't worry about it if you don't. Yeah, it has to do with the shape of the feces, right? So you are going to, I mean, you're in this for the long haul, it sounds. No plans to abandon it. You're there. Even if the business were not to be in the black, you're going to keep those animals alive. And but actually, the prospects are pretty good that Peace Bunny Island will remain a success. You don't see any, you don't have any worries. You don't lose sleep at night, do you?
My right now, my hope is to. I mean, I have 2 more years of high school, and then at this point, I'm hoping to go to college and still taking care of the rabbits. I mean, I have a book now, so there lots of people are following the story. And why would you stop now?
Well, Caleb, all the best to you, and it's a tremendous opportunity to hear your story from your own lips. Thanks for all of your efforts and for telling us about what you've been up to. It's a pleasure to meet you.
You as well.
Caleb Smith with us. He is the founder of Peace Bunny Island. His book is titled Peace Bunny Island: The Extraordinary Journey of a Boy and His Comfort Rabbits and How They're Teaching Us About Hope and Kindness. Most of us are rather fond of animals, and many of those animals, not all, but many, are willing to love us back. And where there's love, there can be healing, and certainly we could all use a little healing in this world with so much harm in it. But every so often you come across an animal healing story that really stands out, and I think this is because it's quirky or original, fresh, spontaneous. Kind of like the teenager who happened upon an island for sale and said to himself, that could become home for my peace bunnies. And also very much like our next guest who had to figure out what to do with an energetic rescue donkey that just wanted to run. Constant Wonder will be right back with that story. One of my colleagues here at Constant Wonder has shown me a picture of a rescued donkey adopted by a friend of his, and I have to say, it's one of the most adorable faces I've seen on an animal in a very long while. I really had no idea donkeys could be so charismatic. Big fuzzy ears, wide eyes outlined in white eyeliner, a soft white muzzle. And I'm going to be guilty here of anthropomorphizing a little bit. This particular donkey in the photo I'm looking at has a deeply sincere and innocent expression. I think if you crossed a koala, an Ewok, and a horse, you'd probably get something like a donkey. Well, maybe there's a reason even that Mary on her way to Bethlehem is traditionally portrayed riding a donkey. And donkeys do get a preferred spot in those nativity scenes I've seen. Well, what use is a donkey to us today? That was the challenge faced by our next guest. Christopher McDougall is a writer and journalist who gained fame 10 years ago with his runaway title, Born to Run. He has a new book titled Running with Sherman, and Sherman, it turns out, is a rescued donkey who probably needed a purpose in life. Christopher McDougall is on the line with us. Chris, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much. I am constantly wondering why I didn't talk to you before I titled this book, because now I want to call it What Do You Get When You Combine an Ewok, a Koala, and a Horse?
It's true. It's perfectly true, isn't it?
there are these moments as a writer where you listen to somebody else and you think, I missed an opportunity. And this is one of them.
Well, I've missed the opportunity of being anywhere near donkeys in my lifetime, except for one time. I hiked the Grand Canyon, and on a hike we passed a train of donkeys. And I thought to myself right then, you're not going to catch me in this place on that animal. It was just too frightening. You've seen that or heard about that?
Well, yeah. Well, no, it's interesting because that is exactly – you really kind of pinpointed the whole genesis of that asinine, stubborn ideology about donkeys. The reason why you want a donkey in a place that's really treacherous is because donkeys make up their own minds. You can't force a donkey to do anything, which is why if you're on a really hazardous – narrow trail above a 10,000-foot drop, you can persuade a horse to do something stupid. You can spur it, you can whack it, and a horse will follow your orders. If a donkey isn't 100% confident that it's making the right move, it won't move at all. So I would say if you had to be on top of anything in a life-threatening situation, a donkey is your best bet.
Well, it seems to me that in your life, there was a shift that happened some point where you said, I'm going to welcome a donkey into my life. And that just doesn't seem like a normal kind of life experience for most people.
No, not at all, and not even for me. And I'm not sure if welcoming a donkey into my life was exactly the kind of context. What happened was, you know, almost 20 years ago now, we moved from Philadelphia way out into the Amish countryside of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And, it was a dramatic life shift for us. And once we got here, we really started to like it. We kind of liked being these, exile farmers, these nation farmers. And we started, getting a couple of sheep and goats. And my youngest daughter, who grew up here entirely, got into her mind that what she wanted as for her 10th birthday was a donkey. And the reason why was, it's kind of genius in a way, because she looked at a donkey and she thought, well, this is much cooler than a horse. It's not as big. It's not as scary. It's not as fast. It's a perfect kid-sized version of a riding animal. And so I kind of chewed it over. I thought, maybe we'll have an experiment. Let's just see what it's like to have a donkey. And when I began asking my neighbors, they said, actually, we know someone who has a donkey. We got to find it a new home. It's in really bad shape. And that's how we ended up taking this creature in away from a hoarder who had it locked up in a stall and then bringing it into our lives.
The donkey was in bad shape, you say?
Yeah, it was in horrific shape. It sort of gave me a glimpse, unfortunately, into the mind of animal hoarders. And, the difficulty is they don't see that they are smothering animals with their affection. So in this guy's mind, this donkey was his family, his pet, his beloved little creature. But when we saw it, this thing was locked in a dark stall, like a closet in a crumbling old barn, up to its knees in muck and manure and rotten straw. It was in horrific shape, and the look in its eyes was just lost. It looked like it was just dying in front of our eyes.
So your task suddenly became not just the purchase of a donkey, but the rehab of a donkey.
That was the thing. So as soon as we saw it, my first reaction was, this is not exactly the birthday gift my daughter had in mind. Maybe this is not the donkey for us. But then immediately on the tail of that thought, I just said, you know what? There's no way we're leaving it here. We're getting it out of here, which was not easy. The hoarder did not want to let it go, but we persuaded him basically that if he didn't let it go, someone else was going to take it away because that donkey was not staying in that stall one more day. But then we got to our house, and that's when we really discovered what kind of really desperate situation it was in. Its hose had outgrown so far that it couldn't walk anymore. It was like standing on skis. So the hose had were grotesquely long and curved up. Its teeth were falling out of its mouth. It had manure like matted into its fur. But most of all, the scariest thing of all was just that dead fish look in its eyes. It just looked like it had given up.
Was it named Sherman before it came to you, or is that something you bestowed upon it?
That was the inspiration of my youngest daughter, Sophie. So we had this kind of running mythology in the house that whatever you name the animal, that's the animal's going to turn into. So we had a cat we named Smarty Cat, and it turned out to be the most devilish cat of all. And we actually had a goat named Bamboozle, and he became a master in jumping over the fence. So she thought, we have to give this donkey a happy name. And we'd just seen a film about the Sherman brothers, the songwriting brothers who did all the Disney songs. And she thought, Sherman, like everybody loves the Disney song. And so that's where the name Sherman came from.
Well, this saga goes such a long distance because at some point you get connected with burro racing in Colorado, I think, and that's a different part of the country. And Sherman ends up being a racing animal.
This is the pivotal moment. So here I am standing in my yard. I have this dying donkey in front of me. I don't know what to do. I'm thinking this is like the worst 10-year-old birthday party ever. And I did know we had met a woman about a year earlier. We'd seen her out in the woods near us riding her own donkey with a saddle. And so, luckily in Pennsylvania, if you're a woman riding a donkey in the woods with a saddle, everybody knows who you are. So I asked around, and somebody gave me her phone number. And her name is Tanya. And Tanya just came zooming in like an avenging angel. And she took this dying donkey under her wing, and she got the hose trimmed, and she got antibiotics into him and pain relievers and cleaned him up. But at one point, she stops, and she looks me in the eye, and she says, you know, if he lives, don't you think you're going to stick him out in the field by himself? He needs something to do. This animal's been abandoned. It's feeling despair. It's like every other creature. It needs a job. You got to find him a job. And I'm kind of intimidated by this woman, so I'm kind of nodding along, like, okay, yeah, all right, I'll give him a job. I mean, I don't have a job for a donkey. But the one thing I knew about was that in Colorado, to this day, there is still an old miner's tradition of pack burrow racing, where people line up with their donkeys, and they run side by side with their donkeys for distances up to 29 miles.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, it's Colorado. You know, it's a weird country out there. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. So, you know, there's sort of the farcical side. It does seem kind of ridiculous. But on the sort of more evolutionary, biological side, you know, humans and donkeys are two species which are uniquely equipped to run long distances. You know, humans are amazing long-distance runners because, you know, we vent heat by perspiration instead of respiration. We are upright creatures. We're very springy. So humans are actually some of the greatest long-distance runners on Earth. And coming, you know, close behind in second place are donkeys. Donkeys are desert creatures. They evolved from the northern African deserts. So they're used to going very long distances. They have a very steady, syncopated gait. And the interesting thing about donkeys, too, is they're great teammates. They're wonderful herd animals. So if you put a bunch of donkeys and a bunch of humans together and you fire off a starting gun, you're actually going to have a really fun race on your hands. When we got this idea of trying to turn Sherman into a long-distance running donkey, I really knew that I needed some specialized help. And luckily, where we live, there is, I think, the world's only Amish marathoning club. There's a group of Amish people, men and women, who run marathons, and they train together under the full moon after work days. So I knew about this full moon Amish running club, and I reached out to them.
Okay, I'm going to just stop you here because I think I heard you say a full moon Amish running club.
Yeah, I mean, everybody doesn't have one. So here's the deal. So, you know, where we live out here in Amish country, running is not a common thing. And so the Amish guys who got interested in running, they couldn't do it during the workday. They can't go to the gym like the rest of us. So they came up with this tradition where every month they would have a run under the full moon. And this would be runs of 10 to 15 miles, and they would meet at someone's farm, and they would map out a route, and then they would just run under the moonlight. And so, you know, every month they would get about 4 or 5 days worth of good runs while the moon was still strong. And so I knew about this group, and I thought, okay, look, these guys are good runners. They know the countryside, and best of all, they really know animals. They you know, transport themselves in horse and buggies. So I reached out to the Amish running club called Bella Springer, which in Pennsylvania Dutch means let's run, and brought them out to the house. And that was a breakthrough moment because this donkey was going through a lot of life changes at this point. It had just been freed from a dungeon. It was trying to get healed, and I'm trying to turn it into a runner. And what really turned the tide around was one night we took Sherman out with Tanya's donkey, Flower, with a bunch of Amish runners. And we set off under the full moon, and off we went. And it changed everything.
I'm just trying to envision this. It's quite idyllic. It's kind of absurd. And it seems not exactly foolhardy, but this is new territory for you, isn't it?
Yeah, every step of the way is new territory. But you know, that's the beautiful thing about it. I think, you know, what this opened my eyes to was that, you know, I think in our lives we've forgotten about the integral role that animals have played in human existence. You know, we've gotten to a point in our lives where we think of animals as commodities or accessories or as kind of little fur babies that we keep in our house. But the thing was, humans and animals worked side by side as teammates for tens of thousands of years. You know, it was wild dogs and wolves, lupines, which taught humans how to track and how to hunt and have a corner quarry. We learned hunting from wolves. we would have feral cats around us at night, not just to take care of rodents, but also as an early warning alarm system. You know, we have this sense now, like when you pet a cat and it purrs and it's so cute and wonderful. But actually, that is an ancestral warning to you that a creature with far better night vision than you, with far more acute hearing, has scanned the perimeter and decided that there's no danger out there. So this is hardwired into the human psyche, except we sort of severed our bond with animals a long time ago. And what I found was the more we tried to re-embrace that relationship with Sherman with the donkey, the more my eyes opened to things of which I wish I'd known a long time ago.
There's something also about animals, and I think you concur with this, that it's not just about their being sort of our antenna out there in the world or helping us to hunt, but there's something internal in us that thrives, I would say. There's some psychological impact.
Well, here's the thing about it. If you think about 10,000 years ago, and you're an early human, you're in that cave, and you are with your wild hunting dog, and that hunting dog lies down next to you and closes its eyes. That's a signal to you that it's safe for you to also close your eyes. And the thing about it is, anything that is good for the survival of the human species, your brain is going to become hardwired to reinforce that behavior. So if that kind of a contact with a wild dog is going to be good for the human species, then your brain is going to reaffirm that by giving you that soothing burst of endorphins, of serotonin, oxytocin, all those hormones that flood through your body to tell you this is a good behavior, let's keep it up. So the thing about us as humans is, you know, we still have the bodies of early humans. You know, our technology has changed, but our physical beings have not really changed very much. So the body you're inhabiting today is not very different than the body your ancestors had 2,000 years ago. The difference is that we've radically changed our day-to-day lifestyle. But if you take a dog right now into a cancer ward, you can measure pain levels, and pain levels will drop in half. Anxiety levels drop in half. You take animals into classrooms with behaviorally challenged children, and all of a sudden behavior improves. So this is a natural medicinal remedy that's right at our disposal, and yet, you know, we sort of forgot about it. We forgot how important that contact with the animal kingdom really can be for us.
So has Sherman the donkey then made you better, made your daughter better, had a beneficial impact on anybody else in your community?
Well, listen, I'll let a different jury decide whether I'm better. But I will tell you a story that was really profoundly moving to us. In the middle of this process of trying to train Sherman to be a long-distance running donkey, you know, the first thing we realized was, we're going to have to throw more donkeys at the problem. You know, having one donkey wasn't going to work. Donkeys are herd animals. So we ended up taking in two of Tanya's donkeys, and so we had a herd of three. But that meant we also needed three runners. So my wife stepped up as a volunteer. And then out of the blue, we got a call from a family friend whose son was a student at Penn State and was having a really desperate struggle with clinical depression, so bad that he had to take time away at home. And he wanted to join us to do some running. He didn't even know about the donkeys at this point. So Zeke showed up just because he wanted to get some exercise and try to turn his mental state around through some exercise. And I said, okay, you can run with us, but it's going to involve a donkey. And Zeke was all for it. And almost immediately, the most damaged animal formed a link with the most damaged person. Zeke and Sherman just took a look at each other, and they go, all right, that's it. You're for me. I didn't want Zeke running with Sherman. I wanted him with one of the other donkeys who was actually a little more stable. But as soon as Zeke and Sherman teamed up, that was it. They were inseparable. And the transformation that both of them underwent over the next 4 months was just heartwarming and really amazing.
Now, is the running here focused on just getting out and being with the animals and running as a runner will run, or the races, the competitions?
You know, I wrestled with this, and my thinking was, if it was just going to be recreational, just a little bit of tootling around every day, it's too easy to lose focus and motivation. And the thing that this donkey needed was to get really challenging movement all the time. You know, the problem with donkeys is that if they're not moving, if they're not showing their legs, they can't actually digest their food. They're really at risk of seizing up, they're having their intestines solidify. And it's a really common problem with animals which are kept in barns, horses and donkeys, because they'll develop colic and they'll literally explode from the inside out. So we knew that this donkey was in such dire condition that it really needed to move and move a lot and every day. And I thought, you know what, if we have a goal that we're aiming for, if we have a deadline, you know, a ticking clock, that's really going to get us out there every day. So that's when I got the idea of, rather than just trying to jog a little bit with this donkey every day, let's give us a date with destiny 1 year from today where we've got to be ready to run 29 miles in the Rocky Mountains with these animals, because that's what's going to really get us out the door every day.
I'm going to tell you as we close here a little story. I've heard that up in the Northwest that when keeping chickens in the backyard became quite a thing, a lot of people got into it. And then within a couple of years, some of those same people got out and they didn't know what to do with their chickens because they didn't have the staying power. They couldn't stick with it. Talk to me about staying power, keeping the donkey in your life for the long term.
Well, I'll tell you, listen, before anybody ever adopts a donkey, you got to ask yourself two questions. Number one, how old is this donkey? And number two, what's the expected lifespan of a donkey? Neither question I ever thought to ask before signing on to this operation. So it turns out, do you know what the average lifespan of a donkey is?
I have no idea.
60 years.
Oh, my.
60 years. And you know how old German was? 8. So, you don't talk about staying power. I got another 50 years with this operation looking at me. So,
way you describe him, though, it sounds as though there's a familial connection here between human and animal.
Oh, you know, it's a funny thing. It's something I never expected. They are so affectionate. Exactly the sort of soulful look you notice in your friend's rescue donkey, that's what it is about them. If I go out in the yard right now and sit outside in the grass with a book, in a matter of 5 minutes, the donkeys will be wandering over, dropping their heads on my shoulder, nuzzling up. They are like gigantic, big-eared kittens, very affectionate, very cuddly, and very, very lovable.
Well, I'm glad you made the comparison to kittens, because felines also have a will of their own, a mind of their own, and from what I hear, donkeys do too.
Yep. Yeah, they are cats in other forms.
Yeah. Well, Chris McDougall, such a pleasure to hear a little bit about this story. It's a wonderful book, and thanks for being with us on the show.
My pleasure, Marcus. Thank you very much for having me.
Christopher McDougall, author of Born to Run, Natural Born Heroes, and his newest book, Running with Sherman. From bunnies and donkeys, now on Constant Wonder, we're going to look at a fantastical kind of animal, the unicorn, in fact. We're keeping our eye, of course, on the Easter holiday approaching this weekend. And so unicorns and Easter, you're wondering? Well, actually, in medieval times, there was a connection between unicorns and Christ. We're going to explain that. But first, if you wanted a depiction of a unicorn or any number of other fantastical beasts, and if you lived in the Middle Ages, you looked for a bestiary. These were gorgeously illustrated collections of animals, real and imagined. I spoke with Elizabeth Morrison at the J. Paul Getty Museum in Malibu, California, where she curated an exhibit on the Book of Beasts, the Bestiary in the Medieval World. One thing I just had to ask her, why were pictures of unicorns so often bloody?
I think it's very much similar to the same reason that we have movies today where things blow up and there's car chases and 20 people die in the first 3 minutes. I think there's something about violence that is unfortunately attractive to the human species, but it can also be something that's a very useful learning tool. And even in those violent movies we watch, it very much has a moral component. And I think that's exactly what you're seeing in the bestiary. And I think one of the best examples is, oddly enough, the unicorn. Now, I think today we think of unicorn slippers and multicolored unicorn, My Little Pony,
yeah,
and unicorn posters and all this kind of thing. And it's a sort of associated with children and idealism and purity. And it was that way in the Middle Ages too. But the story of the unicorn in the bestiary is actually that everybody wants a unicorn. They want the unicorn horn because it has magical powers, but they're very hard to catch because they're so wild. And according to the bestiary, the only way you can catch one is to put it in a to put a virgin maiden in the woods alone, and then the unicorn will come up to her and lay its head in her lap and fall asleep. And then the hidden hunters can sort of jump out and kill the poor thing. And so actually when we did the exhibition, the entire first room was devoted to the idea of the unicorn. And at first the Getty thought, oh, this is so fabulous. Everyone loves unicorns. And then we just kept putting up image after image after image of unicorns being stabbed, blood flowing from the sides of unicorns. And they kept saying, don't you have any happy unicorns? And the point was that in this particular case, that was one of the most important Christian allegories in the entire Middle Ages. I mean, when you think of the unicorn tapestries, which if people only know one image from the Middle Ages, it might be a unicorn tapestry. And the idea was that, again, the unicorn is a symbol for Christ, and that he was able to come down to humanity through a virgin, and when the unicorn came and put his head in his lap, it's like Christ going into the womb of the virgin, and then when he was born a human, it enabled his death. And that was the sort of whole story of the unicorn. So from the medieval perspective, it really makes sense. But from the modern perspective, all those bloody unicorns are perhaps not quite as tempting as one might think.
Well, that does make sense. You know, the whole notion of God made flesh, made mortal, made vulnerable to death. And if you're going to show vulnerability to death, you may as well bring in the gore as well, right? It's the same function as looking at a crucifix, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm. And oftentimes the spear of the hunter can actually be entering the side of the unicorn, just where we're used to seeing a spear enter the side of Christ during the crucifixion. So that was very much in the forefront of medieval viewers' minds.
That was Elizabeth Morrison, Senior Curator of Manuscripts at the J. Paul Getty Museum. Tomorrow is Good Friday. On Constant Wonder, we are going to walk for a little bit in the footsteps of Jesus as we meet a historian who spent 15 years investigating the life and times of Jesus to get some sense for the cultural context in which Jesus lived. He knows more than just a few details, such as why people probably were not wearing those flowing robes that have long been the go-to garb for costumers who are making period pieces in Hollywood. That's Friday on Constant Wonder. Be sure to join us. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.